Well, let's start by setting our motivation for the evening. Tonight we're going to do a review, questions that Venerable Chogyam wrote for us to study, and they're mostly about concentration and bodhicitta, or about meditation and bodhicitta. And during preparing for this, I thought a lot about the power of our minds and our potential. And so I'm hoping that through studying and sharing and going through this, that our minds will become more, that we have the wisdom of learning happening, but also that we're able to see and just consider the possibilities of what our potential is, having a mind and a human body, thinking about especially the mind of bodhicitta that's so vast, taking in every being everywhere, keeping them in our heart, and having a growing and determined conviction that we can develop ourselves to be a benefit to them. So may we do that, take a little step tonight as we spend our time together. So we're on the quiz questions 3 and 4. And my plan is to do it a little different from last week, just because of my level of concentration. So I would like people to please feel free to raise your hand, add in anything, but I'm mostly going to just kind of answer the questions and talk about the topics. And so the first question Venerable asks us to just think about what is stabilizing meditation and what's analytical meditation and how do they relate to serenity and insight. So that was question number 3. And so these are two main types of meditation, the stabilizing and analytical meditation. And the brief answer is that stabilizing or single-pointed meditation is done to develop single-pointed concentration, and the analytical or checking meditation is done to develop understanding and insight. And so, for example, when we do analytical meditation, we might pick a topic that the Buddha taught, and we want to try to understand that very deeply and think about it for logic, and especially important is to relate it to our own experience. And we do this by making many examples in our life. And then when we have a real deep feeling or strong experience on the meaning of that meditation, then we focus on that with the stabilizing meditation. We concentrate on it single-pointedly so that we can integrate that and it becomes a part of us. So that's the kind of sums up the answer very briefly. So really what's interesting to me about that is the part about how checking meditation or analytical meditation helps us to clarify the meaning, because we often hear words and words are like maps. You know, maps aren't the land, and words aren't our experience, but they're describing our experience. So to really get to the meaning of something, we have to really spend some time with things and use that part of our mind. When you know, children talked about this, and especially when Kinzo Jampa Tekto talked about this in the book Transforming Adversity into Joy and Courage. He talked about analytical meditation and related it to the wisdom of hearing, thinking, and meditating. And I thought this was helpful because I always had some confusion about this in the past, and it's come up in a number of discussions, because we talk about hearing, thinking, and meditating, and actually in that little format, analytical meditation is the second one. It's the thinking part. And so I think that what happens here in this topic, at least for me, is there's a lot of different terms, and they're used differently at different times. And so one way to think about meditation is, one definition, like from Alex Berzin, is that meditation is the repeated practice of generating and focusing on a beneficial state of mind in order to build it up as a habit. And so we can use that term in a general way, but in this particular context, what we're doing with analytical meditation is we're actually more thinking about the topic. And that's where I think it's good to explore what analytical meditation is and what it isn't. So, and that's what we'll go into a little bit. So in that, the wisdom of listening, thinking, and meditating, the meditating is the part of when you've contemplated something and then you have a strong experience of it and you hold your mind on that. That's what the meditation refers to there. You're trying to put it on it single-pointedly, but Kinzo Jampa Tekto says, but that is not necessary. And I thought that was a good point, because most of us don't have single-pointed concentration. If that was necessary, it would mean that we'd never, you know, be able to make any progress before we had any single-pointed concentration. And so I think that it's best to have single-pointed concentration, but even though we don't have that, doesn't mean that we don't get somewhere with the meditation that we do. So we look into the Lamrim topics. So with the analytical meditation, the thinking, we're focusing more on the meaning of the teaching and how to practice it. And we want to do all three of these together. So that's why people listen to teachings for their whole life, because it's always a continual process of hearing, thinking, meditating. That's oftentimes when I meet people and I say and they want to learn about Buddhism, I say, well, here's the method. This is a big part of the method, is hearing, thinking, meditating. And the thinking can also include talking to people and discussing and things like that. And so then we take these topics, the various topics, like in the Lam Rim or all the Buddhist traditions, they look at things like impermanence, suffering, emptiness, love, compassion. So then how do we discern that just from discursive thinking, or like our normal day-to-day, analysis of things? Well, it is different. And here's what Kinzo Jampa Tekto said. He said that merely knowing the teachings doesn't constitute analytical meditation. So just when we know something, it doesn't necessarily cause the internal transformation. We have to do more than just I can read something and think it's a nice idea. I can just say to myself, I never want to get angry again. And I could say that to myself all night long, but it wouldn't necessarily help me to, get rid of anger. So it's more than just even understanding something. So it's not just knowing something. It's actually, you have to have an experience. Realizations are generated in the meditation portion of the hearing, thinking, and meditating. So we have to get ourselves to that point where we're now integrating the knowledge into our experience. And so sometimes we have strong experiences. And so where do those fit in? Because a lot of times we have a strong experience, but then it fades away. And what Kinzo Jampa Tekto says is these are positive, they're good, but they're unstable. And these are a kind of belief or a correct assumption. And so What we want to do when we have those kind of experiences is we want to try to make them more stable. So a sudden flash of understanding, like most people here who have been meditating for a long time, will have moments where you'll just, renunciation, and that comes very strongly in the mind, but we notice that we don't hold it. And this is, you know, it's helpful to know that we have to keep familiarizing ourselves to make these things more stable. And then they'll become more stable because we'll understand it more deeply and we will have looked at it from many different sides. So sometimes we might think that we're doing analytical meditation when we're just kind of reading the words or saying the words to ourselves, or especially if we're doing it in kind of an academic way, like we sometimes say, you know, from here up. That's not going to cause the internal transformation. So we want to try to really bring them into our experience. So we need to apply the teachings to our life and then see if it's, you know, does it make sense? Is it kind of logical and consistent? Does it describe our experience? Is it like even, you know, is it more realistic and beneficial than how we're usually thinking? I think that's helpful to think about, because many of the teachings challenge our thinking, and they're meant to, because if we were thinking correctly, we would be a lot happier and less suffering beings. So of course we need to change the way we're thinking. Sometimes I think Venerable said we have to get used to being wrong, you know, and of course we want to change. So, and the one great thing about hanging in with analytical meditation is that it will help to clear up our doubt, because we'll become much more firm. And actually then when people, you know, when you have a belief, at the level of belief or correct assumption, those things aren't stable, and you can get moved by other people. Other people can influence you. So, you know, one example I was reading about this is if you meditate very deeply on precious human life, and actually Dhammakusha, who's going to come and teach her, one of my teachers, one of the things she's always said to me is that, you know, when you really take hold of the precious human life, you'll never be like bummed out. That's not her words, but that's the meaning of it. And because and that's true. And that's why when you really meditate on that and you are able to make the meditation work, your mind just gets happier and you can't hold depression, because you're pulling it in a way where you're really bringing it into your experience. And when you have that very strongly, and I've met people that do, no one can dissuade you. You know, you've got it beyond the level of like, this is a good idea, I think I'll live my life this way, to a level of, it's a firm conviction, and everything that comes up in your life doesn't sidetrack you, because you have a real grasp on what your potential is. And so that's the great value of doing this meditation, life after life. So that's more about the analytical meditation. And then there's the meditative stabilization. So this is where we try to develop serenity, or shamatha. And Venerable's talked about this, and it's in most of the textbooks in the Tibetan tradition. They talk about going through these nine stages, trying to get to this one-pointedness where we can really focus the mind very single-pointedly on any object that we choose with complete stability and clarity of mind. And that's a practice, you know, the developing serenity or shamatha. Both Buddhists and non-Buddhists have this practice, but we're studying the Mahayana paths and grounds. So what is it that makes this bodhisattva? What does a bodhisattva do? It's not just serenity. They're basing this on refuge. They're motivated by bodhicitta. And they're trying to, you know, eventually meditate on emptiness so that they can become fully awakened. So the motivation of a bodhisattva is going to be quite different than someone else, because that's not a particularly Buddhist practice to develop calm abiding or shamatha or serenity. Those are all synonyms. And so if we want to develop serenity, then we need to have good ethical conduct, be pure in our habits and behaviors, and accumulate a lot of merit. And there are many benefits of developing this kind of ability. One of them is that we can focus our lives more on virtue, and those activities that we do will be much stronger in our mind because we won't be so distracted. I mean, it's just natural, you know, when you're kind of multitasking, you know, you can really tell the difference between then when you're really, really focused on something that you're doing and how it's a very different experience. And so when we're trying to develop our good qualities, distraction actually is something that deters us from that. We get sidetracked, we aren't paying attention to what we're doing, it's easier to be on automatic. There's just so many ways that as we develop our serenity, then it's easier to have mindfulness even in our day-to-day activities. So this serenity is also a foundation for generating insight and the union of serenity and insight. And so that's a topic that I'm trying to stay away from tonight because it's a question, I think, for next week. And so I don't want to I'm trying to not take that material. But of course, that's going to be very beneficial because eventually, in order to free ourselves from our afflictions, we need to develop the union of serenity and insight along the way. And if we practice Tantra, we also need to have serenity. In fact, they say you have to have serenity before you can realize emptiness. So it's going to be one of those tools we need in our toolbox. And when they teach about this, they always give warnings. And I think there's kind of two sides to these warnings in my mind. One is that it's easy to become attached because serenity is quite a blissful state of mind. But you can also, without getting attached to it, I think, kind of use that, because what's great about being able to concentrate is that you can subdue temporarily your affliction, so you can actually use it as a tool to work when your mind is quite afflicted, that you can help to kind of settle things down by concentrating the mind, and that's quite useful for some people. You can go at working at the afflictions in different ways. So for some people, going through reasoning and everything works better at some times, and we're all very complex individuals, so it's going to be different in different states of mind. But it is it's definitely known in all the traditions of Buddhism that serenity will subdue your afflictions temporarily, and that's useful. But we have to be careful not to be attached to the blissful states or to get complacent once our concentration is good. Or not to get confused and think that because you can get to a place where you, while you're meditating and you're very skilled at it, you don't have any afflictions. You might think then that you're liberated. And if you don't study well enough, you could make that mistake. And people definitely have. There's stories about this. And they always talk about people who get sidetracked in this way. So that's why they always give the warnings when they give the teachings. And I think it's important to know these things. So basically, I think it comes down to motivation, that we want to have very strong and clear motivations for what we're trying to do. And then also realize that our minds are in a way quite delicate, you know, and we need to have good instruction in this area. And yes, that's a very important thing for all of us to realize. And if you grew up, when I grew up and everyone started meditating when I was like in high school, that was a very popular thing here. We, none of us knew what it was, and there wasn't very good instruction, and people got into all kinds of trouble, including myself. And so I really believe this quite firmly that you know, we need to have really skilled instruction for doing this, and that's how it's done in this tradition. Even people who go off alone and do it on their own, they're being guided. So, and then the other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit in this regard, because I think they make a lot of claims about concentration and the ability that you can develop. And, you know, as growing up in our culture, it kind of sounds like science fiction or something when you hear about some of the things that are said. But my own practice is to try to keep my mind more open and really listen to people's stories, especially, and also look at my own experiences in life and, you know, kind of look at history and listen to people that I have a lot of respect for that have no reason not to be completely honest. So, you know, you hear a lot of stories about the powers of the mind, so to speak. And as people develop their ability to concentrate, there are different kinds of perception and abilities that what they call supernormal powers and things like that that are claimed by the Buddha and many other non-Buddhist traditions. But the Buddha, in this regard, he definitely thought these things were possible. He developed many of these things himself, all of them, that are possible. But he was very clear that he actually forbade he did not allow his disciples or students to talk about these things, to talk about their accomplishments. And he was very focused on that, to use these in order to benefit others. And they would be very beneficial to be able to have the ability, say clairvoyance, for example, to know, you know, like when we're having difficulty getting along with each other, if you know someone's predispositions and you knew kind of all the things that led up to the moment of an interaction, I mean, you'd be working with a lot of knowledge that you don't have right now. So it's, you know, it would be quite useful. But the Buddha, you know, was very clear on this. And so you don't really hear much people talking about these things very much, which is as it should be. And it actually is a precept for a monastic, not for someone who's fully ordained, not to talk about these things publicly. So the point here, I guess, from my side is that just to keep my mind open, and here's one way that helps me, that these are possibilities, something that His Holiness said. He said, theoretically, the ability to know is a natural property of consciousness. Even in our ordinary experiences, we sometimes have premonitions of what might happen. I think these indicate that the seed for such cognitive powers lies within us. Through meditative practices and single point of concentration in particular, we begin to sharpen the focus of our memory and mindfulness. In that way, our ability to recollect experiences increases. As the power of recollection becomes sharper, the potential for precognition is enhanced as well, and this is the theoretical basis for believing in precognition. And I think, when I think about that, it makes a lot of sense to me, and so I'm just putting it out there as something to, you know, don't sell yourself short. Keep the mind open. Okay. And then going back to what Venerable talked about in the grounds and paths. So now if we think about meditation when, say, we're on the path of accumulation, when we get there, and then we're going to start thinking about meditating on emptiness. Well, we'll probably do that before then, but there you're definitely going to want to. And at that point, you're going to then alternate between stabilizing meditation and analytical meditation. So it might be that you, previous to this time, you had a different object. They often in our tradition have the object that you meditate on is the Buddha, or visualized image of the Buddha, or the breath, or, you know, there's many objects that are described in Buddha's practice. But now, when you're on the path of accumulation, you're definitely going to switch your object to emptiness. And so what I want to talk about more here is just point out that it's not the object that determines which of the kind of meditation that you're doing, analytical meditation or stabilizing meditation. It's not the object that determines that. It's how you're engaging your mind with the object. So if you think about this in something more simple, like if you're looking at a photograph, for example, you could just look at the photograph and just still your mind and just see it, almost like a camera, just seeing. and focus on it in that way. Or you could analyze, like, you know, what kind of paint did they use, or if it was a painting, or, you know, to engage with the object with some kind of analysis is a different thing than to use something to calm the mind. And so, so they are different things, and it doesn't. So you can have one object, and your mind could switch into how you're engaging with it. I think that's important to understand in this question of trying to understand the difference between these kind of meditations. So with analysis, it's important to understand that it's not like a bunch of words. You're not like sitting there having a discussion with yourself, like, how did they make this thing, and, you know, or how does this work? It's not that coarse kind of thinking that we're talking about here. It's a very subtle kind of analysis that we're able to cultivate. And with that kind of mind, we can actually penetrate things. And if you only were, say, meditating on emptiness, because emptiness can be an object of stabilizing meditation, and that would be more just like kind of looking at it. But what I read here, which is makes so much sense, is that you wouldn't be able to probe it deeply. And so that wouldn't take you where you need to go to understand reality and see clearly. Just, you have to have this subtle mind of analysis, I think what Venerable calls probing awareness. I think she uses that term sometimes for this. So you have to have that kind of analysis, very subtle analysis, to see how things exist. Not just what exists, but how it exists. And so this understanding of emptiness can't get clearer or deeper or sharper if the mind isn't investigating. So that's an important thing, I think, to understand. Okay, so it's not a bunch of words. We're not debating in our mind when we're doing this kind of analysis. So just, let's see. And then there's this word, insight. So I've talked about serenity so far in this, how these relate to serenity, but relating to insight is going to be more in the next part when we talk about the union of serenity and insight. But I thought I would just kind of say that this word is used in different ways. Some of these words, both concentration or samadhi, is used in, has different meanings in different contexts, and so does insight. And insight, I think it's used different from what I read somewhat in the Pali tradition as in the Sanskrit tradition. And also, we use the word, when it's translated, it's used differently, because I've found different things that confused me when I was preparing. I was quite confused for a number of hours trying to work this out. And so I thought it's useful to say that, according to Alex Berzin, insight itself, just the word insight, is a non-technical term for an understanding of a deeper level of meaning of something that one did not understand so deeply before, or not at all before. And that's kind of a general way that we use that word, you know. And he doesn't even give any kind of Sanskrit or Tibetan word for it. But we use that word that way a lot, and you'll see it sometimes in the literature that way. And in other times, in some people's translations, you'll see special insight. But it seems like in some of the people that we're reading, they're kind of getting away from that term. And so it's helpful to know which one they're talking about. So insight can also be used, although, you know, Alex Berzin uses the word special insight. Guy Newland just uses the word insight. But when they translate it, you see that they're talking about the same word in the Tibetan and in the Sanskrit. The Sanskrit is vipassana for insight. And so you have to know, you know, it's helpful to know that sometimes there can be some confusion there. But that's a different thing. So the way Alex describes special insight is he uses a lot of different words. He doesn't use the word in special insight. He uses the word exceptionally perceptive state of mind. But it's helpful because it gives you, like, it tells you a little bit more to read his, once you understand something and then you read his terms, it's kind of helpful, I find. He calls it exceptionally perceptive state of mind. It's a state of mind that, in addition to being stilled and settled, which is the shamatha, is accompanied by an additional sense of fitness. a subsidiary awareness, which is his word for mental factor, a mental factor of feeling totally fit to discern and fully understand the subtle details of anything. And sometimes you have a little bit of that, don't you, in your experience when you're meditating, where your mind just feels more like it can penetrate deeper. I mean, we have different levels. Even in our own experience, we have some level of seeing the mind being really foggy, dark, a little lighter, maybe able to see more clearly. So we can see that in our own mind, that we have different levels of perceptive, except, well, this one's exceptionally perceptive. So then when Guy Newland, Venable's definition of insight is, it's a wisdom of thorough discrimination of phenomena conjoined with special pliancy induced by the power of analysis. That's a hard one. I think I'll go for Guy Newland's. His is analytical wisdom that directly induces and becomes fused with meditative serenity. So we need to spend some time understanding this. There's a lot to be learned about this, and we'll be going into this in the next week too, so we can just take that as a tidbit. And so let's just summarize this first point and the first question, that when we talk about meditation in general, there's one way to talk about it, that there's two types, both two processes, serenity and insight. And stabilizing meditation is used primarily to develop serenity, and analytical meditation is used primarily to develop insight. And that when we choose an object, the object can be anything. It doesn't have to be emptiness. It could be many other things that you're looking at with this. Yes. Venable's definition of insight, this was from her verbal teaching, so, you know, this is what she said when she taught on this topic. This, most of the material from this from these two questions, especially the next question, come from her teaching of October 13th, 2011 for Grounds and Paths. That's where most of this material is from, and on both these questions. So her definition, which came from that teaching, is it's a wisdom, insight, it's a wisdom of thorough discrimination of phenomena conjoined with special pliancy induced by the power of analysis. And what's interesting with Guy's is that, really, look what he says here, analytical wisdom that directly induces and becomes fused with meditative serenity. So the insight induces and then becomes fused with it. Can you imagine what that mind would be like? I think that would be kind of cool. Okay, so that was our first question. And then, should we go forward? Okay, the next one is not so heavy in some ways. So this one is question 4, and it reads, there are 4 levels of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta of belief or faith, bodhicitta with pure special resolve, fully ripening bodhicitta, and bodhicitta free from obscurations. Which of the bodhicitta paths and grounds apply to these 4? How do the names of these 4 relate to the paths and grounds that they describe? So now we're kind of switching gears here a little bit and thinking about this wonderful attitude and thought of bodhicitta. And so one great practitioner said, when I'm happy, I dedicate this well-being so all sentient beings may accumulate merit. May sentient beings throughout all space be filled with happiness. When I suffer, may my suffering dry up all the suffering of sentient beings. Through my experiencing pain or difficulties, may all others be free of these. So this is this mind that leads us to have bodhicitta wishing to become a, that's the kind of the mind training thought that, you know, is going on when we think about bodhicitta. So last week we went over the definition and the ways to cultivate it. And so these four levels of bodhicitta that she's describing in this question, they come from Maitreya's ornament for Mahayana Sutras. And this is one of these five treaties of Maitreya. And these are written from the mind-only school of philosophy perspective, and all the Tibetan Buddhist schools study these. So the first part of the question is, which of the bodhicitta paths and grounds apply to these four? And so for the first one, the bodhicitta of belief, that is something that is the bodhicitta that's present in those on the paths of accumulation and preparation. So the bodhisattvas on those two paths. And then the bodhicitta with pure special resolve are the bodhisattvas who are in the grounds 1 through 7. Did you guys all work this out?
Yeah.
Good. If you find any errors, just pipe right up. And then the fully ripening bodhicitta, which is the third of the four, is the bodhisattvas who are in the grounds 8 through 10, which are called the three pure grounds. And they are called pure grounds because they're free of all the afflictive obscurations. Those have all been purified. And then the bodhicitta free from obscurations happens at the level of Buddhahood. So now we know for sure that Buddhas have bodhicitta. This was the teaching where that big discussion came up, which I listened to a couple times. Okay, so those are the basic part. There's a little more detail for some of these that we'll get into in terms of which grounds are on. But then she asks us that, how do these names of the four relate to the paths and grounds that they describe? So now we're kind of looking more into, like, kind of what's happening with that kind of bodhicitta? What describing it more from that aspect. And so I kind of want to remind us that in the outline where they do all the divisions for the bodhisattva paths and grounds, we have like two main things. There's the Mahayana causal grounds and the Mahayana resultant or result grounds. That's the word, result, effect grounds. Yeah, so those, the first one are all the bodhisattvas, and the second one are Buddhas, right? So that's the main division. And then in this one, the Mahayana causal grounds, we have bodhisattva common beings, and we have bodhisattva superiors. So now we're going down a little more. So we're first, in these first bodhicittas, we're going to talk about the bodhisattva common beings, the grounds of a bodhisattva common being. And so in the outline, when they say the grounds of bodhisattva common being, who are they referring to? They're referring to the bodhisattvas who are on the path of accumulation and preparation, because they haven't got the direct realization of emptiness yet. So how do they describe, how do they define who is a bodhisattva, the ground of a bodhisattva common being? And this is the point here. The definition of it is a bodhisattva's clear realizer, which is included within the grounds of belief. And here we are, we're talking about the bodhisattva of belief or faith. And so, you know, this is the one where, like on the path of accumulation, they're called a Mahayana clear realizer of the doctrine, and the path of preparation, they're a Mahayana clear realizer of the meaning. So we're still working at that point in your realizations of emptiness on the level of belief. You haven't got direct realization of it yet. So I think understand going back to reviewing how these things are divided actually helps understand the answer more. So when we look at this bodhicitta of belief or faith, these bodhisattvas, they're working included, right, within the grounds of belief, they have generated faith and received teachings. And they name it belief is because it's how they're relating to the subject of emptiness. they think and believe that all phenomena are empty of true existence, but they haven't realized it yet directly. It's not fully penetrated. So there's still an element of belief in their perception of reality. And this kind of goes back to that seven ways of knowing that is described in the mind and mental factors kind of teachings of how we go, you know, how we start off everything, you know, we sometimes don't believe something at all, and then we get to kind of some doubt, but maybe, you know, maybe yes, maybe no, and we kind of move our way along, we get to a correct assumption, we keep moving along, we finally get to an inferential understanding, and then eventually to a direct realization. But there's seven gradations of how we know something, and that's what this is pointing to here. So they have a level of belief. So then, as they, I think I'll do this way, and we'll stay on this topic of the this first level, the bodhicitta of pure special resolve. So that one then is where Venerable started talking about these 22 kinds of bodhicitta, because this one's broken down even more. There were four. There are 22 kinds of bodhicitta described, and that's from another text by Maitreya. And so you might remember that she was talking about earth-like bodhicitta, gold-like bodhicitta, bodhicitta like the waxing moon, and the other one was fire-like bodhicitta. Those first three, the earth-like bodhicitta, the gold-like bodhicitta, and the bodhicitta like the waxing moon, those happen on the small path of accumulation, the middle path of accumulation, and the great path of accumulation. So the earth-like bodhicitta happens on the small path of accumulation, the gold-like happens on the middle path of accumulation, and the bodhicitta like the waxing moon happens on the great path of accumulation. And this is where they told us the story of, how you can say that the differences in the three levels of the, you know, the path of accumulation had these three levels, right? Small, middle, great. And they can be described, the differences can be described by the three occasions of a sick person. There's a sick person who you give medicine, and that they might, let's see, what are their exact words? They've taken the medicine, but it's not certain whether the disease is going to be cured or not. And this is this first ground, the first level of the small, it's called the small path of accumulation. That bodhicitta isn't stable. You could lose your bodhicitta still then. So that's like the sick person. They've taken the medicine, but they might not be cured. That bodhisattva has had spontaneous bodhicitta, or else they wouldn't be on that path, right? But it's not stable. And why they call it earth-like bodhicitta is because just as the earth is the basis for planting and growing crops, this bodhicitta is the basis for all the virtuous causes of Buddhahood. So all the nourishment depends on the earth and all the good qualities that are going to come afterward, these crops, they arise on the basis of generating. You know, all of our good qualities that we generate in this regard arise because of this bodhicitta. So all the nourishment, just as all the nourishment depends upon the earth, it's still not definite what's going to happen. When you plant a seed, you don't know if it's going to grow or not. So that's why they call it earth-like. That makes sense? I'm not sure if I'm so clear always. Okay, and then the gold-like bodhicitta is on the middle path of accumulation. This is the one that, sick person has taken the medicine, although they're certain to recover, but it's difficult to recover quickly. So on this path, it's like that thing of gold is stable. It doesn't change into something else. Like the person's definitely going to get better, but it's buried under the ground, and it might take a while, you know. And so, like gold, the root text says, like gold, although placed under the ground for a long time, does not decay or turn into something else, one is not able to move quickly to the path of preparation. So that's what they're pointing to there. That gold is gold through and through, but it's down under the earth, and you might not see it for a while. So you might have this bodhicitta, But you're where you're at with things, you might not get to the path of preparation for a while still. So it's like the sick person who you don't know when they're going to get better. But they are. Yeah, they won't fall back. That's from there. It's only that very first one where it's not for sure. And then the third, the bodhicitta, like the waxing moon on the great path of accumulation. This is the one, like the three occasions of a sick person, where it's easy to recover quickly. So you've taken the medicine, boom, you're going to get better quickly. And so what they say about this is, just as the moon gradually becomes brighter and eliminates darkness, this bodhicitta helps to continuously increase virtuous qualities and knowledges, such as the 37 harmonies with enlightenment. And so when Venerable talked about this, she talked about all these things that develop, like where you can go by magic illuminations and hear teachings, and statues are talking to you, and you remember every teaching you've ever heard, and, you know, and... Yeah, that would be allow your good qualities to grow much more quickly. Okay, so that's pretty much most of that first one. There's also the fire-like bodhicitta, which happens on the path of preparation. And she didn't talk about that yet much that I'm aware of. So there are 22 of those, and they're spread out in these four levels. So the next level of these four, the first one was the bodhicitta of belief or faith, which is on the path of accumulation and preparation. And the next one, the second of the four, was the bodhicitta of pure special resolve. And this is the one that we said was on the first seven grounds. So this is named because these are Arya bodhisattvas. They have the direct realization of emptiness. They haven't yet abandoned all the afflictive obscurations. That happens when you go to the eighth ground. And that's why, I don't know, understand why that means that so much, but she said that special resolve means that because they haven't gotten rid of all the afflictive obscurations, but it's pure. The word pure relates to the fact that they have direct realization of emptiness. So they are Arya bodhisattvas. And when we talk about those 22 kind of bodhicittas, number 5 through 11 happen on that. And they have beautiful names like treasure-like bodhicitta, bodhicitta like a source of jewels, ocean-like bodhicitta, vraja-like bodhicitta, mountain-like bodhicitta, medicine-like bodhicitta, bodhicitta like a virtuous guide. And those happen on the first through seventh grounds. And I think that we'll be getting into that down the line here. Anyone else have anything on that one to add?
I have a note that the word resolve, special resolve, referred to their resolution to get this direct realization of emptiness. That's their focus. They don't have it, but now they're really resolved.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I have.
Yeah, I might have missed something because I typed this from the transcript, but she may have gone back to it. So what do other people
have? The seven grounds, so they have realized emptiness.
Yeah.
They have realized emptiness.
My notes here.
But so they have realized emptiness
directly.
They haven't abandoned all the afflictive obscurations, and so their resolve is to abandon
the afflictive obscurations. Two phrases wrong in my notes.
Yeah.
Okay. To abandon. Okay, that's the resolve. Okay, thanks.
That's better than how I understood that. I think that was her meaning when she said this. I typed it, the words exactly how she said it, but that makes more sense. And she also kind of, she came back to some of these things and I think the next week, and I didn't type those out and look at them. Okay, so that was the second one. The third one is the fully ripening bodhicitta. Now this is where, I'm missing some notes here. Okay. Yeah, I thought I had more notes on this. Not so many notes on this. What I have is that they're named this fully ripening bodhicitta because all aspirational prayers and dedication are ripening. So they're fully ripening their minds. They're about to attain the fully ripened result of full awakening. So they're like speeding right along now. They're on the grounds 8 through 10. and they're on these kind of the 22 levels of bodhicitta or analogies. They are 12 through 20, and they have beautiful names like bodhicitta, like a wish-fulfilling gem, sun-like bodhicitta, bodhicitta like a melodious voice, king-like bodhicitta, treasure-like bodhicitta, bodhicitta like a great path, bodhicitta like a conveyance, a fountain-like bodhicitta, and bodhicitta like a lovely voice. So there's descriptions of all of these that are meant, I think, to inspire us to understand the different qualities of bodhicitta as it is cultivated. Then the last one was the bodhicitta free of obscurations. Wait, did anyone have any more on that one?
For the 8th to the 10th bhumi, they're abandoning the obstructions.
Right, that's good to mention. So the 8th through 10th bhumi is when you're working on the cognitive obscurations. And so you've gotten rid of all your afflictive obscurations. They are gone. And you're now like just speeding along. So it actually makes kind of sense when as we learn about these more, because this is what we'll be getting into more. I think everything will start to tie together, I think, in terms of the wisdom side and the method side, how they're complementing each other as the two birds, or the wings of the bird are flying along here. And then the last, the bodhicitta free from obscurations, is named this because the Buddhas who possess it are free from the afflictive and the cognitive obscurations, and it's only Buddhas who are free of both of these. So the bodhicitta free from obscurations. And this, I wanted to mention, because I've had a hard time learning the names of these texts. Let's see, where is that? This text that these 22 kinds of bodhicitta are from is another one from Maitreya. That's the Ornament of Clear Realizations. And what they said about these books is those five texts by Maitreya were revealed to a Sangha, and he was in the 4th century in northwest India. These books are studied by all the lineages of Tibetan Buddhism. As I said before, they're written from the mind-only philosophical viewpoint. In the Gelupa monasteries, this one, this Ornament of Clear Realizations, is one of the five principal works that's studied in the Geshe curriculum of the major Gelupa monasteries. And it's the commentaries on this particular text, Ornament of Clear Realization, are, they say, probably the most extensive and influential source of certain doctrines, such as the 10 bhumis or 10 grounds, the 5 paths, and the types of Buddha bodies. And then Lama Tsongkhapa said that this text is the root text of the Lam Rim tradition that Atisha founded. So that's good to know, because that's what we study. So this is one of the core basis texts for our tradition. That's what I prepared. The one thing I learned in reading about this, one impression I had when I was reading about the meditative serenity and the insight from these different traditions and trying to work out the words, is that it seemed like, you know, in the Pali tradition, your goal is different. No, I'm just speaking from my own kind of thoughts, preliminary thoughts about this, because I don't know that much about it. But, with that as your goal, it's a different kind of, I would think it would be a pretty different kind of experience. Serenity might be the same, but the insight part, they say that the realization isn't so different, the emptiness that they're realizing is the same for both the fundamental vehicle and the bodhisattva vehicle. But when they described the insight and the serenity, I was kind of struck with the power. I had the sense, really, that in their practice, in many of these traditions in the, that study the Pali, they focus maybe a lot more on serenity than they do in the Tibetan tradition. And His Holiness says that's kind of something that probably needs to be done more in the Tibetan tradition. In fact, I read something in this that he said that he has a lot of the understanding and insight part, but he actually needs more serenity. You know, his lifestyle is pretty busy, you know. So I think he's kind of given up a lot to help sentient beings because that's what he had to say. And so, yeah, you need a certain level of serenity for things to kind of help the penetration. So.
I was just reading some Dalai Boucher's Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and towards the end of that he has a short discussion about this, about the serenity and the analysis, the analytical kinds of meditation, and he just very quickly kind of lays out that the various some of the four major divisions in Tibetan Buddhism kind of criticize each other,
mm-hmm.
Because like the Kagyus will put people right into long meditative retreats and say it's best to do that because you don't want to have too much discursive, analytical kind of wordy thinking in your mind because you're going to later have problems with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Gelugpas will say, but you don't want your meditating on.
I think the Sakyas would say that too. At least my Sakya teacher did. He laughed when I said I was going to do a retreat. He said, "Well, what have you learned? What are you going to study? What are you going to do?" Because they study first
that
too.
That I think, like His Holiness is pointing.
Yeah, some kind of balance. So even what you're saying is that even in the Tibetan tradition, amongst the four major schools, of course they have kind of their views about how the other schools go about things, and some schools start earlier, even before a lot of people have had as many teachings, doing long 3-year retreats, and then some other schools say that, well, then what are you going to think about? You know, you don't have the background. You know. So maybe we should do both.